Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, along with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus, will present Johannes Brahms' A German Requiem this Saturday night. Brahms' Requiem is not really a requiem in the liturgical sense. It's not in Latin. It's in German. You'll hear no equivalent language to the Dies Irae or the Requiem Aeternum. Rather, Brahms' Requiem is a humanistic journey for the mourners and dead alike, and opens with "Blessed are they who mourn." It's a spiritual journey. Leading the choir and orchestra will be James Bagwell, a familiar face to Tulsa concert and theater goers. For 10 years, he was the music director of Light Opera Oklahoma. Currently, he's a professor of music at Bard College, where he heads the choral and conducting programs. He's also the principal guest conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra and associate conductor of the Orchestra Now, as well as a chorus preparer for choral works by the New York Philharmonic, the Boston Symphony, the Mostly Mozart Festival, and a number of international orchestras performing in New York City. He'll lead the Tulsa Symphony and Oratorio Chorus in Brahms' A German Requiem this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. James, welcome back to Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to Tulsa.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
I know with all the weather problems on the East Coast, there was a question of whether you would actually be back.
Well, I did sleep on the floor of the Atlanta airport, so I was glad to get here yesterday.
Yeah. You're doing the German Requiem. This is a great work. Is this a work you've conducted before?
I have. Okay. I did it with the Collegiate Chorale and prepared it for a number of different conductors, and you know, it's really one of the great masterpieces, and it's the piece that put Brahms on the map as a composer. In fact, he wrote it before he wrote his first symphony. It's a profound work, and the fact that it's in German sets it apart from other requiems, which are typically in Latin. And Brahms himself actually regretted calling it a German requiem. He said he wished he'd called it a human requiem because it sort of became associated with nationalism a little bit. So, but it's a really fantastic work.
Not only is it not set in Latin, it also doesn't use the proper of the Requiem Mass,
no.
too. He finds biblical verses of comfort. And
that's
it's really,
right.
It's a requiem for the survivors.
That's right. That's really the idea, is that blessed are those who remain. And then it's not until the end that he uses the text, blessed are those who have passed. And the way in which he's arranged the text, it's different biblical passages that he has arranged in such a way that in and of itself is kind of an amazing task, and the way that he did that. He avoids a lot of dogma in this, and it is the idea of comforting, even getting as personal as the mother in the fifth movement, in which he talks about how a mother comforts one in the same way that we can be comforted by each other. So it's a personal piece for him, I think.
And he arranges these biblical verses in a way which, again, it has a bit of a narrative,
mm-hmm.
but it's also, as you mentioned, it avoids the dogma. And it, you know, for all flesh is grass, and mm-hmm. grass, you know, goes on and says, and grass eventually withers.
Right.
That's about as judgmental,
yeah.
you know, when you think of German Lutheranism.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
You know, this is a very humanistic work.
It is. And it's also a piece that I think draws from the past. He uses some of the same texts that Bach uses, and Heinrich Schütz, and the fugal writing, the imitative writing, reminds one of Handel, who loomed large over the 19th century and with choral composers. So it's very linked to the past, but yet has a progressive view of what a requiem could be.
Yeah, but it's utterly Brahms, though.
It's totally Brahms, and down to the orchestration. In fact, the piece opens without the violins. So for those of you who go to the concert and you wonder why the violins are just sitting there, they're not on strike. They're just not playing in the first movement. So the thing opens with cellos and violas and all the lower strings. So the piece has that sort of typical Brahms sort of dark, warm sound from the very beginning.
Now, one of your normal gigs a lot of times is preparing choruses for really big concerts in New York and Boston,
yeah.
and major orchestras with the superstars of the conducting world.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm sure you've done this work as a preparer. Mm-hmm. What do you take from those experiences as far as guiding your own interpretation, or do you really try to start fresh with the text and find your own way?
It's a combination of both. You know, I always start with a clean score and mark it up and try to start fresh. But, you know, a lot of choral conductors don't like giving it away. You know, you do all the work with the chorus over a period of time, and then you hand it over to the maestro. And I actually like that because I feel like I get fresh ideas, and it's sort of like, you know, you watch Riccardo Muti work, and that's, you know, a lot of people don't get that opportunity. And so I feel like I get lots of refreshers and new ideas and technique and so forth. So I really love the role of preparing.
Has there been anything in this particular piece of seeing, say, a Riccardo Muti or, Andres Nelson or one of these great conductors? They say, you know, oh, this is a good thing. I need to remember this.
Yeah, it was Robert Shaw, actually, for me. I sang this with him several times. And in fact, I was able to get a hold of his orchestral score with all his markings. He probably had the biggest influence. And actually, there's a new recording. I don't know if it's new or not, with Simon Rattle in Berlin, which is very, very beautiful. You know, the range of interpretations of this piece are amazing. And one of the great things is that we actually have Brahms' own tempo markings from his conducting score. Mm. And some of them are surprisingly fast compared to, you know, some of the performances from the 30s and the 40s, which can be slow, slow, or slowest. So it's very eye-opening.
And, of course, as a conductor, as you well know, when you're conducting this music, this music longs to be milked in a way.
That's right. It's a test of one's own resolve to not editorialize. Brahms did a pretty good job himself, so I don't need to add anything.
So do you try to follow his tempo markings?
To a degree, I think some of them are okay. There are some things that I do a little bit quicker or a little bit slower.
I would think you're also looking at a 19th century orchestra,
that's right,
which, you know, doesn't have as modern instruments, as capable, you know, just
right,
instrument technology has changed for the orchestra, and training has changed,
yeah,
dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So your players are,
right,
no doubt, at a higher caliber.
Right.
So
you,
they're able to do things that Brahms might have not have been.
Well,
able
and
to.
He did. He workshopped this piece to be, you know, use modern terms. He tried it out with several different formats and orders of the numbers. And it really wasn't until the 1870s he did a performance in Vienna where I think the whole thing was complete, and it's the form in which we know now. So it really, he worked on this thing for quite a long time, almost 10 years.
I was really struck by, you know, you mentioned that this appears before his first symphony, and in the second movement, which is a sort of a very funereal, mm-hmm, sort of movement. That was actually a sketch for a scherzo of a symphony,
yeah,
which I'm trying to put my head around. How could these themes work as a scherzo when they work so beautifully as this very solemn second movement?
Yeah, he worked out things. He was very, very detailed in the way he worked and a little bit secretive. He would mail things to Clara Schumann. He mailed a number of these movements for her to look at. And then there's this story, and I don't know if it's true or not, it's that he would write a fugue every day and send it to a colleague. And then when he would receive the new editions of Bach, the collected works of Bach, he would go through and look at the counterpoint and find mistakes or hidden octaves or something, you know, whatever. It's too technical. But he was very much a craftsman. And it's not surprising that he would spend so much time workshopping it. And you're right, that second movement is probably as solemn as one could be.
And of course, we think of a scherzo as a rollicking.
That's right.
At least moving quickly, if not a happy movement.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, what's the biggest challenge in putting this work together?
I think getting the text across. That's the hardest thing, and also trying to keep the overall sense of structure to the thing. You know, the first movement and the last movement end or have the same material, so the piece is framed, and so what goes in the middle of that frame is very important in terms of pacing, tempo, and also not letting the thing become maudlin. It's quite an optimistic piece and quite Baroque and classic in its design. And so I try to honor that, you know, through transparency with the orchestra and tempos and things like that. So it's not in any way a depressing piece. It's actually quite positive
and uplifting, really.
Very uplifting piece.
Yeah. Getting the text across for American audiences, German, mm-hmm. not the most sympathetic language.
No.
What are some of the ways you try to get the text across?
Well, with German, it's a matter of consonants and trying to, you know, it's amazing that you can communicate in another language just through the sheer syntax of the – well, not syntax is the wrong word, but certainly the sounds of the language. Tod, which means death. You hear that enough times and it begins to sound like what it is. It's on a sort of an onomatopoeic. And so I'm trying very hard to get the clarity of consonants and the clarity of the vowels as well. And the text repeats themselves quite a bit. So you hear the same thing. And there's the word grass. That sounds exactly like English grass. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that one can recognize in this.
You know, tote, I would assume, is almost you'd make that as dramatic as
That's
possible.
Right.
Because
right.
Death.
Death, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, why don't we hear a little music, and this is probably the heart of the Requiem. This is the fourth movement. To translate it into English, it's How Lovely in Your Dwellings. And it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of music. You often hear choirs do this unaccompanied
right.
or with organ.
Mm-hmm.
It is really the center of
right.
Of this Requiem. What is your approach to doing this?
The tempo is the problem, because if it's too fast, then it starts to sound like a Viennese waltz. If it's too slow, then it starts to sound, you know, again, sort of maudlin. So just trying to find the right tempo in this is tough, I think.
All right. Well, let's hear. This is the Atlanta Symphony performing this.
Okay.
So here we are on Studio Tulsa. Just a brief moment there in the beautiful Requiem by Johannes Brahms, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra and the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus with my guest today, James Bagwell, who will be conducting the concert, which takes place this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. James Bagwell, who's a frequent guest in Tulsa many years ago with Light Opera Oklahoma mm-hmm. and regular guest with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He's a professor of music at Bard College and a principal guest conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra and the associate conductor of the Orchestra Now.
Yes.
And this is that's really interesting. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Sure.
What for you in this moment, in this particular piece, the place where you just want to sink your teeth into it, is it this movement or say the sixth movement or?
You know, the movement that I find so incredible is actually the final movement. Which is the culmination of a lot of the ideas that we've heard already. You know, this piece is highly unified by certain melodic ideas and intervals and rhythmic ideas, and everything sort of comes to, a peak in that last movement, even though that last movement is probably the most contemplative of them all, and there's no fireworks in that movement, you know, the way there are in the previous movement where you get the death, where is thy sting section, and mm-hmm. this This is completely different and probably a little more abstract. And one can see where Brahms might be going. So I think that's the one that right now is the most interesting for me.
Yeah, and it's Blessed Are the Dead.
Yeah.
And it's basically, it's again, to follow that abstract idea, it's, you know, death has happened.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think it's their labors will outlast their life. I'm fracturing that pretty badly, I'm pretty sure.
Right. And there's this great moment where the text is, Ja, der Geist spricht, the spirits, yes, the spirit speaks, and it's accompanied by the trombones. And it's just an astonishing moment, you know. Again, with this Brahms sort of dark quality to the orchestrations. So,
and you mentioned the dark quality, and I think of this piece as sort of, even though it is uplifting, it's but there's, the orchestra has this, it's just sort of a, I don't want to say a muted quality, but there's this veiled quality,
yeah.
I think, in the orchestration. How do you work to get
he
that?
He layers everything in the lower part of the registers, you know. Mm-hmm. Even the chorus doesn't, the range is not that big. The hardest thing for the chorus is just getting through seven movements of very intense singing. There's really no break for the chorus. So it's a marathon, and it's a matter of pacing. But going back to the original question, is again, he just, the horns sit low, the violins play in a lower part of the register. So that's, and again, that's sort of the Brahms trademark a little bit, is that sort of dark quality and warm quality, and it works very well in this piece.
Yeah. Do you get a sense of where, you mentioned the last movement sort of gives you a sense of where Brahms going? Do you feel like that last movement is sort of pointing ahead to the big symphonies that he's going to write?
Could be. You know, his first symphony is an homage to Beethoven, and actually there's moments in the Requiem that are sort of have some quotations a little bit veiled of Beethoven. Brahms was a composer who was considered by critics at the time as an absolutist. That is to say, his music was about his music. It didn't have an extra musical meaning like, say, for example, a Strauss tone poem, which is a setting of, or a musical interpretation of Nietzsche philosophy.
Or Don Quixote.
Don Quixote, story, or right. Storytelling sort of thing. So Brahms was interested in this piece is about this melodic idea. And so the fact that he's working with text, I think, allows him to begin to work through some of these things so that then he can take text out later on and develop musical ideas.
And yet I think there's a real program to this.
Oh, yeah.
This Requiem.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he's telling a story.
He's telling a story, but he's doing it in a very Brahms way. It's as though he's looking over it. And as opposed to being in the middle of the story, he sort of looks down on the story, not in a negative way, but sort of from above, you know,
yeah.
In a more philosophical way rather than sort of a personal way.
Yeah. For many years, you were directing Lido Opera Oklahoma here each summer for a number of years, and of course, I've been at Bard College for a number of years.
Yeah.
And I think one of your latest adventures is with this, the orchestra now, which you're the academic director of,
right,
as well as the associate conductor. This is a really interesting project where you're creating this next generation orchestra, if you will.
That's right. It's a 3-year program. In which the players are sort of at the cusp, you know, they're between having finished master's degree, in some case doctoral degrees, and are beginning to go out and audition for orchestral jobs, for which there are so few. And so this is an opportunity for them to learn a lot of repertoire and get a master's degree at the same time, and it's sort of a curatorial degree. So they learn how to manage an arts organization, for instance, how to have a productive and happy life as an orchestral player, and being able to do as many different things as possible, such as learning how to organize a music festival or learning how to organize something in the public school systems that they might initiate, in addition to playing concerts at Carnegie Hall and jazz at Lincoln Center. We just did a concert this past weekend that I conducted in Queens and SUNY Purchase, and trying to explore as wide a breadth of pieces that we can find as well. They do a concert just about every other week. They're doing Dream of Gerontius, for which I prepared the chorus actually tomorrow night and Sunday. So I'm actually in two places at once, even though I'm not.
Now, for pre-professional orchestras, and this is almost a professional orchestra, mm-hmm. but it's sort of the last training ground. The big change is to go from having several weeks or 3 or 4 weeks to mm-hmm. prepare a concert to 3 or 4 rehearsals.
That's right.
How big a jump is that?
Well, I think it is a big jump for some of those players. And you know, we do, you know, start a rehearsal on a Monday, in the case of my concert, and then put it on its feet and perform it on a Saturday and a Sunday. So a lot of it depends on the repertoire. But we are trying to follow the model of a typical symphony orchestra anywhere, so that students then can go in and, well, they're not. I don't really think of them as students.
Really, I mean, at this point, they're probably working musicians.
Yeah, they're really on the professional side. So, the only reason I would say students is because they are getting a master's degree at the end of this. But they're a fabulously talented group of players, and there's a seminar in which we discuss, you know, the cultural context of the music that they're working on, and also teaching them how to, you know, give a concert, pre-concert lecture, which is something that's so important that now, you know, audiences want to hear from the players, mm-hmm. and trying to recreate or redefine a little bit of what classical music can be in a culture that's, you know, in a sense, feels a little removed from that, I think. It's somehow marginalized itself, not on purpose, but just in the way things are in our culture, and a prevalence of pop culture is trying to get audiences to not be afraid of this, you know, that this is great music and it's, you know, beautiful and enjoyable and not to something that one should fear.
And you're talking about all the extra musical roles that a musician has to play.
Right.
And that wasn't trained.
No.
10 years ago,
no.
20, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, it was all about just learning how to play the music. These are essential roles
yeah,
now.
Yeah, practice. Now they need to know how to talk to a board of directors. They need to know how to go to a donor and ask for money. They need to know how to do their taxes. You know, there are these basic kinds of things that one doesn't necessarily learn in conservatory. How to contextualize the music for an audience as well. It's part of a culture, you know. It's part of a culture. And we're willing to suspend our disbelief and see a play by Ibsen or even Tennessee Williams or go look at a piece of art from the 16th or 17th century. But I think with music, sometimes that's a little bit harder without a little bit of context for the mm-hmm. audience.
And when you look at a model like the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, where you have musicians doing all these jobs, mm-hmm. do you think that's increasingly going to be the future for a lot of orchestras?
I think so. I think the orchestra in any community has to be part of the community. It can't just appear on a stage with tuxedos. It has to be inside the schools and inside the community in order to really work and be successful and to expect people to support it. You know, that older model worked in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but I think it has to evolve, and it has evolved in a lot of places. It
certainly has evolved, even among the top echelon of musicians in mm-hmm. New York City. I mean, you have people like Wu Han and David Finkel running their own record label.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, highly trained and highly the elite level musicians now are having to be their own entrepreneurs mm-hmm. as opposed to having an impresario who sort of fulfilled that role
That's
for
right.
these artists.
That's right.
Is this something you're also trying to ingrain?
We want our students to be able to go out and be independent, entrepreneurial, happy people, you know, and not feeling marginalized by just going to a rehearsal and then leaving, you know, so that they feel as though all the New York freelancers that I know, they have, you know, 5, 6, 7 jobs. They teach, they organize chamber music concerts. That's what the musician's life is, you know. It's a variety of things.
And really that's sort of a divide between the successful freelancer musician really and not, because right. you have to juggle all those roles and you have to engage in these things that they probably weren't trained to do.
That's
coming
right.
out of conservatory, That's even right. though they were the finest player, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, being the best player is fantastic, but if you can't talk to an audience about what you're doing, you know, it could be a bit of a divide between the audience and the player.
My guest today is James Bagwell, a guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, along with the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus, as they perform Johannes Brahms' German Requiem this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. He's also the associate conductor of the orchestra now, which we were talking about. He is a professor of music at Bard College, works with the Bard Festival in the mm-hmm. summer, works with a variety of major choruses and orchestras doing major pieces, and I assume you're busy doing that as well or getting prepared for another one.
Right. Well, I'm preparing the Tanglewood Festival chorus for a Mozart Requiem in Boston, and I've already started rehearsals, and that comes up the week after Easter, which is week after next.
Mm-hmm. So. Busy summer. I know the summer festival is always a big thing.
It's Chopin and his world, which is an interesting. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing Berlioz, Romeo and Juliet, an opera by Dvorak called Dmitri, which I don't think has ever been performed, staged anyway in the United States. So it's a busy summer.
Yeah, well, we wish you great success with that and hope a lot of people come out to hear this beautiful work by Brahms. It really is a gorgeous work.
Yeah, it's something that you don't want to miss. It's to hear this piece and its contemplative nature and we're living in a time where contemplation is also side by side with some hysteria. And to have a moment of contemplation is welcome indeed.
All right. James, as always, a pleasure.
Thanks
for joining us. James Bagwell is the principal guest conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra, associate conductor of the orchestra now, and guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, the Tulsa Oratorio Chorus, as they present Johannes Brahms' German Requiem this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. For ticket information and details, visit TulsaSymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. We're going to leave you with music from the Brahms Requiem. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.